Digital 410 Productions proudly presents What's the Scuttlebutt Podcast?
Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt Podcast with your hosts Don Abernathy and Jeff Copsetta.
What is going on, everybody, in WTSP World War II land? More importantly, what's going on with you in Texas, Jeff? How are you doing, friend?
Oh, man, if I was doing any better, I guess I'd have to be two people.
Oh, yeah? That good, huh?
Man, we, you know, I live in the heart. I think I bragged about this last episode. I live in the heart of Texas wine country, and I was just walking out and about on the back 40, and, man, all them grapes are coming in, so it's a lovely time of year.
What is the preferred grape to grow in the Texas wine country? What's the preferably when it comes to wanting to get a vineyard up and going?
That's a really good question. There's about three different kinds of grapes that grow just on our place up here. Muscadine is kind of pretty popular. It's not a very popular wine, but it's a popular grape that just kind of grows wild here. But you can imagine all of the wineries around here that have their little grape stock, all the birds that eat them and the seeds spread everywhere and cross pollinate and everything. So there's all kinds of grapes growing out here, man.
When did the vineyard thing pop up in that area? Has it been going on a while or is it relatively new?
No, as far as I know, I don't know the time frame, but apparently in France there was some huge brush fires decades ago that knocked out a lot of the French vineyards over there. And it was actually they had transplanted a lot of the grapes from here to France to actually help get that thing back going again. So Texas and France and, of course, like Napa in California, it's all, you know, kind of similar amounts of rainfall and atmosphere. And I guess so they grow just as good here as they do over there. So, no, I think it's been like this for quite some time.
Well, the only reason I ask, I know it sounds like a silly question, but I grew up in northern Kentucky, and there was never any vineyards there. And I left, you know, I moved to Ohio, but I stayed in the area, in the tri-state Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky area until 2001. Then I moved to California, and then I migrated down to Florida. And I went back home to Kentucky like a year and a half ago. In the area of Kentucky where I grew up, there's all these vineyards now. It's like the northern Kentucky vineyards and wine area. It's like, when did this happen? When did somebody come here and figure out, oh, the mineral content of the soil or the water that comes from these springs, whatever, you know, because it gets cold during the wintertime, you know, we have snow and all that. So I guess they either have a growing season or they do it in greenhouses. But for some reason, someone decided northern Kentucky was like conducive to growing grapes. And all of a sudden that area is now considered wine country in Kentucky. And I was like, when the hell did that happen? I've only been alive for 42 years. And this just happened within the last 10. Who decided that this was the thing to do? So that's why I kind of asked if it was a growing trend in that area or if it has some legacy there. That's the only reason I asked.
Yeah. I think it has some legacy.
What is 4th of July like in the Lone Star State?
It's pretty wild. I attended a wedding.
It was a beautiful wedding.
Yeah. So I didn't get to do all the cool 4th of July festivities that we typically do, but, it was a little more chill than years past, of course, with everything. And I know probably some of our listeners who don't live in Texas probably think that we're just a bunch of, rowdy rednecks down here, just catching stuff on fire and shooting guns in the air. That's not always the case.
No, that's what we do down here in Florida.
Civilization.
Well, I got to say, the barn that you were at, that was freaking beautiful. That place was outrageous.
God, man. Yeah, that was just a beautiful venue. That's not 10 miles north of me, just out in the middle of nowhere country, just beautiful rolling hills. And it's called Hidden Ranch or Hidden River Ranch, I think it was. Hidden River Ranch. And no kidding on the name, because you go through this big, beautiful automatic gate and it seems like you're driving forever on this private land. Just whitetail, you know, grazing everywhere and these big, nice ponds with these huge windmills and, of course, thousands of live oak trees. And you finally crest this hill and see the venue, that barn like that you saw and the reception hall. And overlooked a huge pond, and it was beautiful. It was just so typical Texas, man. It really was. It was awesome.
My parents lived out in Texas in the early 2000s, and sadly, I wasn't able to visit them at their home there. So the only time I have been to Texas was when I was out there hanging out with you, and I love the state. I think it's a beautiful place, and I get excited every time I see anything coming out of there. I got so excited, in fact, that I had to trade in my Toyota Tacoma for a Tundra that was built in San Antonio, so I at least brought that home with me, I guess. But
right.
Real quick, before the show, you know, as I mentioned on past episodes, a friend of mine a while back, he worked in radio, and he thought it'd be a great source of content for this podcast. He got me the New York Times complete World War II, the coverage of the entire conflict. Basically, what this is a republication of every single news story that the New York Times put out, even up before the war, when things started popping off in 1938. It even goes back a little earlier than that when they're covering world events. And one of the things I like to do is the day that we record a podcast, or if there's a holiday or something of note that has just happened, I like to go into the book here and find some news stories. You know, it's pretty cool. This, you know, on this date in 1943, this is what the New York Times posted. And Jeff, I got to tell you, I don't know if it was the Times, maybe because we had decorum, or if we had appreciation for the nation in itself, unlike what we're seeing now. Reason I bring this up is, okay, let's turn to the book. Let's see what happened on July 4th, 1941. Nothing. The New York Times did not post anything about the war on July 4th. They posted the text of Stalin's broadcast on July 3rd. The next story that they posted wasn't until July 7th. So it was almost like they took the holiday off, or they didn't want to distract people from the events. Or maybe I'm just, reading a little too much into this. Maybe there wasn't anything going on. So let's skip the 1942. July 2nd, they put a story out. Nazi claims ports. July 5th, Navajos complete training as Marines. Once again, no news story ran on July 4th in 1942. Okay, once again, maybe it was a slow news day. So let's skip ahead to 1943. They ran a story on July 1st. MacArthur starts Allied offensive in the Pacific and didn't run the next story until July 6th. So once again, they took the 4th and the 5th off. And the story continues. We go down to 1944, July 3rd. Inquiry confirms Nazis' death camps. 1,715 Jews said to have been put to death by the Germans. The next story, July 5th. Nazis continue to guess about General Patton's army location. And then let's go to the end of the war, 1945. July 2nd, 4,000 tons of fired missiles bring ruins to four enemy cities. The next story about the war wasn't until July 17th. So I just thought that was a little insight, because once again, this book claims to have every single, you know, news or story that the New York Times ran during the war. And it's just, I just found it a little interesting that every year through, even before the war, well, from 1941 to 1945, they ran nothing on July 4th or 5th. It's like they're just trying to go on vacation, maybe just give a world a break from the bad news, which is complete opposite of what goes on now.
All right. We feed on negativity.
Now the media is like, hey, everybody's home on vacation. Everybody's home watching TV. Let's get everybody on the panel, double down, and just talk about how horrible everything is. And it's just,
right.
Can we bring decorum back a little bit? That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
That would be nice. But, you know, history does repeat itself, so it'll come back.
Yep. Down here, because of the COVID and all the cancellation of the 4th of July events, they actually made fireworks legal here in Florida for this year. Now, I know some of you at home scratch your head saying, wait a minute, I was down in Florida last year. There's fireworks stores all over the place. You're trying to tell me they're illegal? Yes, that's why when you go to a store in Florida to buy fireworks, you sign a consent form. If you actually read it, it says, one, that you will not detonate said fireworks in the state of Florida, or B, if you do detonate said fireworks, you're doing so because you're a farmer and you're scaring the birds away from your crop. So this year was the first time we didn't have to pretend to be a bunch of farmers. This episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast is brought to you by our friends by At Computers. At Computers has been providing IT solutions for all of Southwest Florida since 2004. whether it's network needs, computer needs, anything technology related, whether it's cameras, you need to hook up the Amazon Fire Stick in the lobby of your business, whatever. And right now, with everybody working at home due to COVID, I cannot express the importance of two-form authentication. Secure your network with your employees logging in from home, and you can't consider your network secured unless you have your data backed up. So give AtComputers a call at 239-283-1120. They will hook you up with iDrive online backup solutions for 7 cents a gig per month forever. So give them a call at 239-283-1120. And as always, even if you don't live in Southwest Florida and you need some computer help, they can log into your computer with your assistance via their website. So regardless of where you live, give them a call and they can help you out. And thank you guys so much. The shirts have been, you know, our little K-Ration shirts we put out?
Yes, I love mine, dude.
I posted a few pictures, and kind of what I was expecting to happen is happening. The people who know what that means, what I've been getting a lot of, hey, where can I get that shirts at? And so I think we sold like a few more of them. And then I just recently made a Second Amendment shirt that I just got my copy of, and I posted a picture on Instagram. Not even promoting a shirt, just posted a picture, different topic, and someone's like, hey, where can I get that shirt? And so if you want to support the podcast and everything else we do here at Digital 410, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com and get yourself a K-Ration shirt or any of the other WTSP World War II shirts. And we have the dinner shirt out right now, but supper and breakfast will be coming soon. And while you're there, click on that Patreon link, sign up for Patreon, get exclusive access and content to the exclusive OG5 podcast. Sometimes we put up exclusive videos, and you can get free stickers. And basically, whenever we come up with merch that we want to demo test before we send them out to the masses, you guys get first crack, and usually for free. So it's all more reason why to sign up for Patreon and support the show. I just wanted to have Jeff come on and hang out with us for a little bit before we get on with our interview. Coming up here shortly, we are interviewing World War II vet Jake Larson. If you're on TikTok, you can see him at the channel at Story Times with Grandpa Jake, and guys all over the internet. He's got YouTube videos and he's on news broadcasts, but he has a great story. I sat down with him for, I don't know, over an hour and a half, and we got from D-Day up into San Lo and touched a little bit on his experiences and the Battle of the Bulge. But we decided that instead of rushing through everything, we're going to bring him on for a follow-up episode here in a few weeks. So if you enjoy this interview we do with him today, stick around, and the follow-up interview will be up here soon. But before we get into the interview, I just want to ask Jeff, you got anything else going on in the World War II front over there in Texas?
Well, I can tell you I just finished an incredible book. For those who know me, I am always my nose is always in a book, and 9.5 times out of 10, it's World War II. And I have just got to recommend this book real quick. It's called Deadly Sky, John C. McManus. I was fortunate to, in my real job, to host a webinar that McManus was a part of, a super awesome, nice guy. Probably the most renowned Army historian today during World War II. I think he's more known for his book, The Dead and Those About to Die.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing he's doing a trilogy right now about the Army in the Pacific. The first book was Fire and Fortitude, I want to say, is the first one. But anyway, Deadly Sky, it was published about 20 years ago. And so I told him, I said, man, I know this is kind of like old news to you, but man, what an incredible book. He weaves so many oral histories together, and it's not just the European theater. It's the Pacific. It's CBI. It's just, if you were an American aviator in World War II, he has found a way to hit every niche of what it was like to be a fighter pilot, a bomber crewman, every different position on a B-17, B-29, personal experiences, comparing, contrasting, you know, what life was like living in England as opposed to just sucking it up in the jungles on some island nobody even knows how to spell, you know. But so, yeah, for all of our readers out there, for our listeners, dude, Deadly Sky, I mean, it is awesome. But, yeah, with that, I'm going to sign off because here in a couple days, I'm going to Port Aransas, Texas. That's down along our coast. We have over 600 miles of beaches down here.
Beautiful.
That's New York City. That's New York City to, like, Atlanta, Georgia. That's a lot of beach.
Well, I think I'm going to give Port Aransas, your first. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, just to say, Port Rance is one of the islands off the coast here, and we get on there every year as a family. So I will definitely be posting on social with our WTSP t-shirts while I'm down there social distancing on the beach.
Well, two things before we get to the interview. Real quick, I think I'm going to give you your official first ever WTSP homework assignment, and that is to get the author of Deadly Sky on the podcast, because if his book is great as you say it is, why not get a little preview from the horse's mouth, if you will? And for you longtime WTSP World War II listeners, well, you know we have a good back catalog. I think we've done about 6 to 7 podcast interviews with different authors throughout the years. And if you guys haven't heard our archives, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. You can click on the archive links. I have slowly tried to start to partition off the website a little bit. I have the obviously our primary focus is those who are there. So I've gone ahead and put all the World War II vets on one page. I'm going to put all the interviews with the authors on a page so that you guys can kind of go back and, you know, quickly get to those episodes you want to hear without digging and sorting through the archives to find them. So hopefully by next week or when this podcast goes up, there will be a page on our website. Just go to WTSPWorldWar2.com. You'll see the link for those who are there, and then there will be a link for authors, and then we'll, you know, have the living historians and then historians, etc. And if you guys haven't gone back and listened to some of the back episodes, one of the interviews, obviously I'm super proud of all of our veteran interviews, but a really good interview that you guys, if you're into the history of firearms and particularly the original Springfield Armory, I had the privilege to sit down with two of the historians at the historical Springfield Armory site, and we talk about how it was selected by George Washington all the way up through the development of firearms on the location up to when they shut it down and the name Springfield Armory, which since it was started by the government and George Washington back in the day, it was never copyrighted. It was public domain. And so once they shut down, someone bought the name and then held onto it for a few years, sold it off to the people that you know now called Springfield Armory, who make your XD9mm, your Saints, and all that. But other than the name, there's absolutely no relation. So we get into that in great detail. So go check out that episode in the archives as well. That is a really fun episode. Before I let you go, Jeff, I had someone share a concern with me. I don't know how you feel about it. And he said to me, I'm concerned that if these riots and protests don't stop, it's going to kill the hobby altogether, reenacting. And I said, well, you know, I could see it sadly having a huge impact on the Civil War community, but I don't know too much about the World War II stuff. And he's just, because obviously we all have so much financially invested into this hobby, and this particular gentleman has, you know, even more than I could even imagine with firearms and Jeeps and all that stuff. But how do you guys feel? If you're listening to this podcast, is that a concern of yours? Let us know on the Facebook page or send us an email at info@WTSPWorldWar2.com. But has that concerned you at all, Jeff?
Not in the slightest, because history doesn't go away. You can try to change it all you want, but it's not going anywhere. And there's too many of us that, like you said, are too vested in it and believe in it too much to let it be changed by something that I don't think is going to stand the test of time, like our subject matter. What we're going through right now is being put under a microscope and enhanced in so many different ways because it's sensationalism and it sells. History doesn't sell. We always try to sensationalize history, but if we just truly dig back to what actually happened, it cannot be written any better. A screenplay for a movie could not be better if they just followed history to the letter. And I wholeheartedly believe that. So it's going to stand the test of time. And what we're concerned about or what some of our folks may be concerned about will not. And that's just my personal opinion. I'm not worried about it in the least.
With that being said, if you guys live in a state or town or community that provides you with living history events, especially if they're at a state park or a federal park or a city-owned property, I can't express you how important it is to support those events, because the best way to prevent them from getting shut down is to show up, is to donate money. And I think that's more what he was concerned about, especially down here in Florida. We've already had a lot of the state-owned parks have already prevented any weapons demos with any weapons using brass cartridges, which is great if you're Civil War or French American or, you know, anything prior to World War One. But that completely prevents World War One, Vietnam, World War Two, Korean, etc. from doing, you know, we can do living history displays, but sadly, without the bang, bang, boom, boom, a lot of times the public aren't interested in showing up. And so I think he's concerned that the fact that we've already lost a lot of events in this state due to that, he's concerned that the state will continue to fall under the pressures of angry groups of people and just kill it off down here altogether. And I think, you know, that's his primary concern. I don't feel that way. Once again, I think the guys in the Civil War camp, no pun intended, will probably have more of a problem just because of some of the symbols that were around during that time that are in the news today. I think some of the events may get a little pressure, but like you said, and like we all know, a good thing and a bad thing about modern day society is we have a short attention span. It's a bad thing because we don't like to focus on anything, but in events like what's going on now, it's kind of a good thing that hopefully, kind of like Jeff insinuated, that this whole thing will pass by soon and we can get back on with our lives. But hopefully it don't affect our community more than it already has. And once again, if you guys see, actually, I have to tell you guys, are listening to this because you're down for the cause, but maybe encourage people who aren't so much down for the cause or don't know about the cause, maybe encourage them to, you know, we should do a take a greenhorn to an event day where we thoroughly encourage you guys to find people who's never been to a living history event or display and take them to see why it's so damn important and to help, you know, support the groups and the communities that put these things together, because as you all know, if the public don't show up, the events don't go on.
That's right.
Well, Jeff, I appreciate your time, but we got us a good interview coming up, and I know you're going to be going out of town, but I will touch base with you here soon, and you got a homework assignment now. We're going to try to get your first guest ever on the show. And thanks. It's good talking to you. We love having you on.
Yeah, man. I'd be interested to see what the feedback is from the listeners. Be interested if we get any emails or anything on social about any concerns like that. I'm glad you opened it up. I'd like to hear what people say, and I'd love to discuss it with them.
And I think it's also important, and one of the things I enjoy about having you on the show is, one, I have somebody to talk to, but, you know, we kind of opened up the show, and we didn't get into anything World War II related for at least 15 to 20 minutes, but I think the audience may enjoy that because it makes it more of a conversational-esque atmosphere, maybe less of an education forced down your throat type thing. And so, and plus, I think it allows the audience to get to feel like they're knowing us on a personal level more than, you know, us coming on just getting right down to brass tacks. So I really enjoy just the free-form banter that we have before we get down to the task at hand. And I hope you enjoy it too, and I hope the audience enjoys it. So let us know if you guys want us to stop talking about wine and, you know, 4th of July and just our personal lives and get down to brass tacks, let us know. And if you enjoy it and you want more of it, let us know too, so we can shape this show to please you guys and to bring in more people. And the ratings are up. Thank you guys so much for that. And so just keep listening, share with your friends, and thank you guys so much. Thank you, Jeff.
Yep, thank you guys.
And joining us on the phone, we are very proud and happy to have Mr. Jake Larson. As I said before, I came across him on his TikTok account ran by his granddaughter, Michaela, called Story Times with Papa Jake. Mr. Larson, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing just great.
Happy to hear.
I can't remember when I had an acre of pain. Of course, I'm only 97 years old, 97 and a half. In December, I'll be 98.
That's beautiful. You ready to take a little trip back in time?
Absolutely, always. I think that's what someone has saved me for, because I enjoy telling my stories, and there's people enjoy listening to them. So that's what keeps me going.
Well, let me ask you this. I've often said, and maybe you can agree or disagree with this, but I often said that other than family and friends, life is a series of stories, and it's the stories that you can tell and your life experiences that you can share with the younger generation, with the exception of your family and friends. That's the key to life.
It is the key to life. I never told any of these stories to my family while they were growing up. They heard them while I was telling these stories to the high school history classes. And I came home and then told those stories, what I told there. And I've got a lot of followers in high school that depended on my stories for information of the Second World War.
And that's one of the things we like to do here at the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. And so let's start telling some stories. One of the things I like to do whenever we have a veteran and or someone who was living at that period of time, it's a simple question. It kind of sets the pace. Do you remember where you were during Pearl Harbor?
Do I ever? Yes. I was at Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. I had joined the National Guard when I was 15 in 1938, along with my first cousin, Chick Larson. We joined the National Guard at 15, and in 1939, we went to a year's training at Camp Ripley, Minnesota, and in 1940, we had another month training in Camp Ripley. In 1941, we were inducted into Federal Service February 10th, 1941. I had just turned 18 in December, and Chick was still 17. He's 4 months younger than me.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Hope, Minnesota. On a farm. I grew up on a farm that had no electricity, no running water, and we milked 30 cows by hand.
Wow.
Every morning and every night.
Well, the reason I asked is you said you went to basic training at Camp Ripley, Minnesota, and I was thinking, well, if you grew up in California or Arizona, someplace hot, and then you went to Camp Ripley in Minnesota, my next question was going to be, was it during the summer or winter? And if it was in the wintertime, how did you handle it? But since you grew up in there on a farm, it was just another day for you, right?
That was it. I was born in December, so cold never made any difference to me. It was a survival at that time. I was born up in the time of Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a part-time bootlegger because they couldn't make a living with the farming. He had farmed 160 acres with horses. They had no tractors or anything like that. And they lost the farm because they couldn't make the payments.
Wow.
And when Roosevelt got in there with the New Deal, he started the Federal Land Bank. And I can remember my parents going down to Blooming Prairie, Minnesota, where they had a land bank set up there, and he borrowed the money to pay off that payment.
You know, I think a lot of people don't realize back then, if you didn't live in a large city or a suburb, a majority of the country were farmers, and a majority of the young men and women grew up on farms, and that probably really contributed to what you guys were able to do during the war.
Yeah. The payment he couldn't make, that they were going to take the farm, was $500.
Wow.
$500 today sounds like chicken feed. At that time, it was life and death.
Yeah.
So the reason we joined the National Guard at 15 years old was for the money. every 3 months, we'd receive a check for $12. $12 was like money from heaven at that time, when you don't have a penny. I had to work my way through high school by helping work for a lady that had 8 room and boarders. And for my room and board, I ran home at noon and put that dinner on the table and cleared the table and ran back about a mile to school. Couldn't go out for sports. That's what got me to join the National Guard. And it's things like that that probably pulled me through the war and saved my life, because I had more training than anybody else. I was in an infantry company.
What division were you assigned to?
The 34th Infantry Division, the Red Bull.
Nice.
So
after boot camp, when did the orders come out for you guys to ship out overseas?
You got to realize I was in before the war started.
Yep.
Pearl Harbor started while I was down in Camp Claiborne. And 1 month after Pearl Harbor was when my 3-year enlistment was up.
Wow.
So the Japanese taking Pearl Harbor there just delayed my retirement.
Yeah, because
the duration, that's the way that they put it. You're in for the duration. But I have no regrets.